This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Turbulence by David Soloy. Read by Gabra Zachman.
One. LGW to MAD. On the way home from the hospital, she asked him if he wanted her to stay. "No, I'll be fine," he said. She asked him again later that afternoon. "I'll be fine," he said. "You should go home. I'll look at flights."
"Are you sure, Jamie?"
"Yes, I'm sure. I'll look at flights," he said again, and he already had his laptop open. She stood at the window, unhappily eyeing the street, the view of semi-detached Notting Hill villas and leafless little trees was very familiar to her now. She had been there for more than a month, living in her son's flat while he was in the hospital. In January, he had been told he had prostate cancer, hence the weeks of radiotherapy in St. Mary's. The doctor had said they would now wait a month and then do some scans to see if the treatment had been successful.
"There's one tomorrow afternoon at 5-ish, he told her. "Iberia, from Gatwick to Barajas. Is that okay?"
She had been privately wondering whether to make the journey by train and ferry. She told herself not to be silly. She knew it was silly, her fear of flying. The statistics spoke for themselves.
"Yes," she said. "That's okay."
She turned to face the living room again. Jamie was on the sofa, twisted sideways over the laptop, tapping at it. He had lived in this flat for decades, since his early 20s, all his adult life. There was something neurotic, she thought, about his unwillingness to move. He was in his 50s now, which was strange. She still thought of him as someone young.
"Okay," he said, shutting the laptop. "That's sorted."
And she thought how easy it was these days to do that, to acquire a plane ticket, to travel around. He insisted on accompanying her to the airport. They took the Gatwick Express, didn't speak much, and parted when she went through security. She was tearful, which wasn't like her. A minute later, in the snaking security queue, she turned, hoping to find him still there. He wasn't there. And she had the feeling, as if seeing the future, that he was going to die of his illness, that he would be dead within a year. She was still trembling with the force of the sensation as she struggled with the large plastic tub and took off her shoes. Once she was through security, she went straight into one of the fake pubs in the departure lounge for a Bloody Mary. She had a second Bloody Mary, and then, when her flight was announced, walked to the gate. It turned out to be a significant distance. When she arrived, there were a large number of people already queuing there, more, she thought, than the plane would be able to hold. She wondered if they would need volunteers to stay behind. They didn't. She was in a window seat. She looked out at the low sunlight on the gray tarmac. The plane started to move. Then it stopped. It seemed to be in some sort of queue itself. In regular sequence, the rumble of jets arrived faintly from somewhere she couldn't see. The tedium of all this had almost succeeded in sedating her when the pilot's voice, momentarily present in the cabin, muttered,
"Prepare for takeoff."
She felt the fear then, even through the vodka, surging up like the sound of the engines in a series of well-defined stages, first one kind of loudness, then another, as she was pressed into her seat and the safe world went past in the window. She never quite believed, at this point in the process, that the plane would take off. She always found herself thinking, surely it should have happened by now. Something must have gone wrong. And so it always took her by surprise. It was always somehow a profoundly surprising moment when the plane's nose lifted, when the plane pulled itself free of the earth, or the feeling was actually more like the earth was falling away. Sussex was already quite far down, a bluish patchwork of fields in the dusk. There was, from somewhere, a quiet ping. She did not know whether it soothed her or not, that ping. She wondered what it meant. Though it seemed to say that everything was happening normally, it probably meant nothing. She looked around, as if surprised that she was still alive, and for the first time she noticed the man in the seat next to her. He was sitting very still, with his hands knitted loosely in his lap, staring straight ahead. Perhaps he too was trying to master his fear. She was going to have to ask him to move at some point. As soon as the fasten seatbelt sign went off, she turned to him and said, "Excuse me." She pitched her voice nice and loud. It was surprising how loudly you had to speak to be heard over the noise. Sure enough, the man looked at her in momentary incomprehension, as if he had no idea what she wanted. "Excuse me," she said again. It was awkward, the way he had to move past the empty aisle seat to let her through. And she wondered, making the same move herself, why he didn't simply take the aisle seat, since there was no one there. They would both have more space that way. When he eventually sat down in the middle seat again, she found herself irritated by his obtuseness. She even wondered whether to suggest to him that he move, and a form of words came to her. "It might be more comfortable for both of us if you sat there." It was the sort of thing she normally would have said, with an encouraging smile. In this case, however, she worried that the man might infer some sort of prejudice in the suggestion, some sort of racial prejudice, and that was enough on its own to hold her back. She didn't think she was racist, but she found it difficult to be sure, which made her self-conscious in situations like this. She wondered whether to speak to the man. He didn't seem to be English. The handful of words he had said to her as they shuffled around each other in the aisle had had what sounded like a French accent. And anyway, he seemed preoccupied himself, absorbed in his own thoughts, whatever they might be. With small tinkling noises, like tiny scratches on the underlying roar, a trolley was approaching in the aisle. She stirred airline Bloody Mary with a little plastic baton. The engines purred in slow, rhythmic waves. She felt the vodka work on her. The tightly packed fabric of the world seemed to loosen. Her mind had more primacy over it. Her thoughts started to seem like things that were actually happening. Her son's death, for instance, presented itself in a series of images that felt so true they made her silently tearful. She turned to the window and found only her own face in the dark plastic now, deeply shadowed like a landscape at sundown. She imagined herself, after his death, emptying his flat, taking everything down from the shelves, all the stuff that he had held on to so tenaciously for so many years. It was then that the first wobble went through the plane. What she hated about even mild turbulence was the way it ended the illusion of security, the way that it made it impossible to pretend that she was somewhere safe. She managed, thanks to the vodka, more or less to ignore that first wobble. The next was less easy to ignore, and the one after that was violent enough to throw her neighbor's Coke into his lap. And then the pilot's voice, suddenly there again and saying in a tone of terrifying seriousness, "Cabin crew, take your seats." In the eerie provisional stillness, when it was over, she opened her eyes and they met those of the man sitting next to her. He was shaken too. Now that the worst of the fear was past, he was starting to attend to the spilt Coke on his suit trousers. She handed him some paper tissues, and he thanked her. And after that, they talked a little about why they were each on that particular flight. The man told her that he had been in London for work. She asked him what he did. She didn't feel well. The shaken feeling that had followed the fear was turning into something worse, a kind of dizziness. She felt things moving unpleasantly around her and saw in the man's face that she must look terrible. She felt sick. The man was asking her something she wasn't able to make out. He said it several times, and then he stood up and went. When she opened her eyes again, her head seemed to be on the man's seat, and she was looking up at a dark-haired woman. The woman was asking her questions in English with a strong Spanish accent. "Are you diabetic?" was one of them. And she managed to nod when she heard it. Then the woman said,
I'm a doctor. I'm here to help you.
Thank you, she said, not sure if her voice was making any sound. And that was the last thing she was aware of until she was being sick on the floor of the plane. There was a lot of noise, and she thought, with her head hanging near the carpet, that the plane must actually be crashing now. Then she understood that it was landing. They were in an ambulance, she and the Spanish doctor. The paramedics had injected her with something, and she felt stronger. She had wanted to go home and not to the hospital, but apparently that wasn't an option. As the ambulance went sirening through the streets, they were sitting inside it, and she was telling the doctor about the turbulence, perhaps forgetting that the woman had been there herself.
I've never been so afraid, she said. I shut my eyes and told myself to face the fact that I was about to die. I had no doubt that I was about to die. I was sitting there with my eyes shut, and I was thinking, if I'm going to die, please let Jamie live. Please let him live. Please, please, let him live.
She stopped for a moment, and then said,
I don't normally do things like that. I don't know who I thought I was talking to.
Maybe it was God, the doctor suggested with a smile.
I don't believe in God. That's my point.
Aware that she was being oddly open and talkative, and vaguely wondering what it was that the ambulance men had injected her with, she said,
The weird thing is that now I have this hopeful feeling about the whole situation. I was so down about it. And now I have this feeling that it's going to be okay. That Jamie's going to be okay.
The doctor smiled again. The ambulance had stopped.
Here we are, she said.
2. MAD to DSS. Sheikh knew something was wrong when Mohammed wouldn't look him in the eye.
What is it, Mohammed? He asked him.
Mohammed said nothing. He had been waiting at arrivals with some other drivers. The terminal was quiet. It was late, after midnight. The flight from Madrid had been one of the few still to arrive. Mohammed took the suitcase without saying a word. As they stepped into the warm night, Sheikh told him about the turbulence that had hit his flight from London to Madrid, laughing as he described how he had spilled Coca-Cola all over himself and how he had tried to use a hand dryer in the men's room at Madrid airport to dry his trousers. Mohammed didn't seem to be listening. They stopped at the black Lexus, and he silently stowed the suitcase and then opened the door for his employer.
Oh, Mohammed, Sheikh said, sprawling in his creased suit across the leather seat. I am so very tired.
It was always an odd feeling to start the day in London or somewhere like that and end it here, in Dakar, at home. The hotel room overlooking the leafless park where he had woken that morning, where he had stood at the window and watched people in dark clothes hurry along the wet asphalt paths, some of them with umbrellas, seemed like something he had dreamed. It was strange to think that the same people would walk along the same paths tomorrow morning, without him being there to see them.
The Bay of Biscay,
he said, trying to find Mohammed's eye in the rearview mirror,
is notorious for turbulence. Did you know that, Mohammed?
Not meeting his eye, Mohammed just shook his head.
You didn't know that.
Sheikh waited for Mohammed to say something. He didn't. They had encountered traffic and were moving slowly.
You didn't know that,
Sheikh said again. And again, Mohammed said nothing. The thing was, Mohammed was usually an encouraging and interested listener. This detached silence was strange.
What is it, Mohammed?
Sheikh asked. The man pretended not to hear, and Sheikh wondered whether his wife had threatened to leave him again. Maybe he was embarrassed to talk about it.
Is it Mariama?
Sheikh asked, without delicacy.
No, sir,
Mohammed said.
What then?
The traffic moved, and Mohammed, steering around a large pothole, used that as a pretext not to answer. People walked barefoot by the road. They emerged from the darkness into the dim, shadowy light under one of the street lamps. Then they disappeared into the darkness again.
As light momentarily fell into the car, Sheikh tugged at the fabric of his trousers, trying to see the extent of the coke stain. Yes, that had been what's known as severe turbulence. It had lasted for 10 minutes or so. It had seemed, in other words, to last forever. Sheikh had been afraid. When it finally ended, in the eerie and provisional stillness that followed, his eyes had met those of the woman sitting next to him. She was English, the woman, and in her 70s, probably. Some withdrawn English quality, a way she had of hardly seeming to see him, was all that he had noticed about her until then. He was dabbing at his lap with a napkin, where the coke had spilled. Without saying anything, the woman had offered him some paper tissues from her handbag. They got talking a bit after that. When he asked her why she was going to Madrid, she said she lived in Spain. She had been in London visiting her son, she explained. He was not well, she added, folding away her tray table. And he suspected, from the way she said it, with a preoccupied and unhappy look as she folded the table away, that it might be something serious.
I hope it's nothing serious, he asked.
Oh, it is quite serious, she said, not shirking the fact. He was still holding the damp tissues, wondering what to do with them.
I'm sorry to hear that, he said.
When she asked him whether he had children, he tried not to sound too smug about it.
Yes, he said. I have 2 sons.
He ended up showing her pictures on his phone. She must have asked to see them. He flicked through them, holding the screen where she was able to see it.
This is Amadou,
he said, showing her a picture of his elder son in a Manchester City football shirt, standing astride the moped he loved so much.
And this, he said, swiping past a few other shots, is Didier, the younger.
Full of pride, unable to stop himself, he told her that Amadou was hoping to go to university in France, and she said, I'm sure he'll do very well there.
Inshallah,
Sheikh had murmured piously, slipping his phone into the inside pocket of his suit. Then he noticed that the woman didn't seem well. She was suddenly very pale, and her eyes looked empty. He asked her if she was okay, and she didn't seem to understand him. That was when he went and told one of the flight attendants, who asked over the PA system whether there was a doctor on the flight, which there was, a Spanish woman. They were in traffic again, the city and its smog thickening around them. Palm trees, their trunks partially whitewashed, lined the road in patchy artificial light. For the first time, he saw Mohammed's eyes in the rearview mirror. They were slightly red, as if he'd been in tears.
What is it, Mohammed? Sheikh said. Tell me. Why won't you tell me?
Mohammed shook his head impatiently. Sheikh sighed, making a show of his own impatience. He didn't like the way Mohammed kept things from him.
Money, he asked. You have a problem with money.
There was no answer to that.
If you have a problem with money, Sheikh said,
in a tone that suggested he could easily solve such a problem if Mohammed were only open with him.
No, sir,
Mohammed said.
Sure? Yes, sir.
The traffic started to move again, and Sheikh tiredly massaged his eyes. The hours in Madrid between flights had seemed to last forever. He looked at ties in Salvatore Ferragamo for a while, wondering whether to buy one out of sheer boredom. He said to Mohammed,
And you're sure it's not Mariama?
No, sir.
How is Mariama?
Mohammed just shrugged.
And the kids?
Mohammed did not answer this. He seemed, in fact, to tense up, and Sheikh wondered if something might have happened to one of the children. Mohammed and Mariama had 4 children. Mariama had been no more than 15 when the first of them was born, and Sheikh thought how pitifully young that seemed to him now that he had a son, Amadou, who was that age, and still so obviously just an innocent kid. Mohammed himself had been older, of course. He was, what, 10 years older than her? Something like that. Neither of them exactly literate. There had been problems over the years. Sheikh and his wife had tried to help. There's only so much you can do, though. Some things, perhaps, are not meant to be, Some things are meant to be. Some things are not meant to be.
Sheikh pressed him. So they are all well? Your kids?
Mohammed answered with a minimal nod.
El Haji,
Sheikh said, referring to Mohammed's eldest son. He was almost exactly the same age as Amadou. As small children, they had played together, had been friends. Sheikh had permitted that, up to a point.
He's doing well,
he asked.
Yes, sir,
Mohammed said in a voice that was almost a whisper. Sheikh was paying for El Haji's education at a private school. Not the same private school that Amadou went to, the new French lycée in its sleek modern building with its tennis courts and its Mandarin option. A simpler, more local one.
Still a decent enough school, and El Haji, though unlikely to go to university in France, would have an opportunity to make something of his life.
It pleased Sheikh that he was able to do this, to make such a decisive difference to someone's life, to be a figure of such transformative power in the world of Mohammed's family. He said,
Then what is troubling you, Mohammed? Do you have something to tell me?
Yes, Mohammed had something to tell him. That was suddenly obvious, from the way, when Sheikh asked him the question, he just stared straight ahead, with this dead expression in his eyes. Sheikh found, from nowhere, that he had a quiet hankering for a cigarette. It had been more than a decade since he had quit. Amadou, at 5 years old, having been told that smoking killed people, had one day asked his father to stop. And Sheikh, after thinking about it for a moment, had stubbed out the cigarette he was in the middle of smoking and promised his son that he would never smoke another. There were not that many people in the world who actually cared about you all that much, and if you were lucky enough to have a few who did, he thought, then surely you owed it to them not to destroy yourself thoughtlessly. Surely you owed them some sort of effort. Since that day, he had not smoked a single cigarette. He was proud of his willpower. Occasionally, though, at moments of stress, the hankering still came.
What is it, Mohammed?
He asked in a quieter voice. They were nearing the house. They were in smaller streets, streets on the hill next to the sea, where the smog was thinner and there were larger trees, their stiff dropped leaves littering the asphalt under the streetlights. Outside many of the properties were sentry posts. They were nearing the house. There it was, its high metal gates.
Stop, Sheikh said.
Mohammed stopped the car in front of the gates and sat there, still staring straight ahead through the windscreen. The headlights lit up part of the white painted metal of the gates. The paint was speckled with rust. Here, next to the ocean, with the tall surf chewing away at the foot of the hill, the spread of rust was a never-ending problem.
You have something to tell me, Mohammed, Sheikh said. What is it?
There was a long silence. Then Mohammed said,
Madame will tell you.
His hand, as he worked the remote control that opened the gates, was shaking. Sheikh was afraid. Something terrible, he now understood, was waiting for him inside the house. With a scraping noise, the gates slid open and they drove in.
What is it?
Sheikh asked.
Why are there no lights on?
Mohammed had nothing more to say. After a few seconds, Sheikh emerged from the car, and slowly, as if he was going to his own death, walked up the steps and into the dark house. 3. DSS to GRU. They said the boy was dead. It happened too quickly for Werner to follow. There was a sudden smash, and the taxi squealed to a stop, making him lean sharply into his seatbelt. Nothing too serious seemed to have happened. The taxi driver said some swear words in French as he pulled on the handbrake. He would obviously have to get out. There would be words to be had. Werner assumed it wouldn't take long. At first he didn't move from his seat in the back of the taxi, an ancient Mercedes, probably an early 1980s model, and the color of swimming pool tiles. Most of the taxis in Dakar were like that. He sat there waiting for the driver to do what he needed to do, so that they could be on the move again.
He was thinking about Zabina,
the woman in Frankfurt he was sort of seeing. They had slipped into a kind of non-exclusive arrangement that for a while had seemed fine to him. Increasingly, though, he had found himself wondering what she was doing when he wasn't with her. It had happened almost imperceptibly, over a week or two, the shift from something like indifference to the state he was in now, in which he was phoning and messaging her more and more often just to satisfy himself that she was alone. He looked at his watch. It was late afternoon. Low sun shone through a line of palm trees with partially whitewashed trunks. The road ran along the ocean. On a wide beach, numerous games of football were in progress on the sand. Werner noticed that a small crowd had formed near the taxi, and people were shouting. He leaned out of the window, trying to see what was happening. And when he was unable to see that way, he opened the door and half stood. A moped lay on its side, damaged. No one, however, was paying any attention to that. The crowd had gathered around what seemed to be a young man, also lying on the warm asphalt, motionless, and wearing, as far as Werner was able to make out, a pale blue football shirt. A policeman was there now, in his military-looking uniform, trying to make the crowd stand back and asking questions. He obviously wanted to talk particularly to the taxi driver, and Werner looked at his watch again. If this went on much longer, he would need to find another taxi somehow. Traffic was building up behind the incident and filtering slowly past. A blast of wind from the ocean made the palm trees wave and clatter.
Il est mort,
Werner heard someone say, someone who had been hanging around on the edge of the crowd and now had to leave, had somewhere to go to. Werner also had somewhere to go to. He wondered what to do. It seemed terrible, in a way, to worry about getting to the airport on time when a boy was lying dead on the road. It was, he thought, the first time he had actually seen a dead body. Not that he could really see it. He saw the motionless limbs, but he could not see the face, the eyes. There was a dark liquid on the asphalt. It looked too dark to be blood. But that's what it must have been. The sun was low in the sky, and shadows stretched across the road. The policeman was asking the taxi driver aggressive questions. A few other policemen had also appeared now. Werner looked at the beach again. He hated beaches. In the distance, the oceanic surf was visible as a mass of white spray hanging in the evening air. When he was 5 years old, his sister, Liesel, had drowned in the sea. His earliest memories were of that day, of moving with terrible, frantic fear among sun umbrellas and loungers with his father, who was holding his hand painfully tightly. The sand was also painfully hot under his feet, though the overwhelming sense of emergency prevented him from mentioning that as his father almost dragged him along. The place was a small seaside resort in northeastern Italy. It was popular with families with young children because of the way the water was so smooth and shallow. You could wade out hundreds of meters, and it was still only waist deep. He wasn't sure which of the images in his head were actual memories of that afternoon, and which were things he had been told in the years since then. Probably most of them were things he was told afterwards, although he had no memory of anyone ever describing that afternoon to him, or talking much about it at all. He had an idea that, as he and his father hurried over the hot sand, someone started to make an announcement on the public speakers, that a woman's voice, speaking Italian, started echoing metallically in the air. Perhaps he understood that what the voice was saying had something to do with the fact that Liesel was missing, as that was apparently when he said to his father,
I hope Liesel isn't gone, because I love Liesel.
Some years after the event, he overheard his father telling someone else that he had said that. Of course, he had no memory of loving Liesel, and found it hard to imagine what he might have meant by it. He knew, as a matter of fact, that for nearly 4 years they had been together practically all the time, which was strange, as he was now unable to remember a single moment of those years, or a single thing that his sister had actually done. He never saw her again. When they went home, he was surprised to find that her bed had disappeared from the room they shared. Even so, it was a long time before he understood that he really would never see her again. It was a long time as well before he understood that his parents would never be the same again either. In other words, for a few years, he thought that it would be possible to go back to how things were before. That Liesel would somehow reappear, and things would be like they were. It was hard to say at exactly what point he realized that that was never going to happen, that this new situation was one that was going to last forever. He looked at his watch again. He would need to find another taxi. He stood at the road's edge, trying to flag one down. The sun was setting, and the muezzins were starting up. Each time there was a faint crackle of static, and then the voice would launch into the words, the long, stretched-out syllables. Allahu Akbar. He was half an hour late to the airport. He apologized and told the captain, who had already started the walk-around when he arrived, that he would explain what had happened later. They finished the walk-around together and went up the outside steps into the plane, which was an old McDonnell Douglas freighter, strange-looking, with its third engine stuck in the tail. Werner would be flying it. At the head of the runway, he waited for permission to take off. A voice in his earphones,
Lufthansa Cargo 8262, runway 1, cleared for takeoff.
Cleared for takeoff, Werner said back.
Runway 1, Lufthansa Cargo 8262.
The engine spooled up to a high-pitched whine and then delivered their thrust, at which the plane started to move. It picked up speed, and when it was traveling at 278 kilometers per hour, it took off. Werner always liked to think of the fact that at that moment the plane was unable not to take off, that nothing would be able to hold it down. The ocean slipped under its nose, the blue curve of the planet. 2 hours later, they were still ahead of the night. The night was moving faster than they were, though, and overtook them somewhere over the Atlantic. The sky flamed on the western horizon. The ocean winked as the sun fell into it.
Contact now, Atlantico.
The voice of the air traffic controller, still in Dakar.
Thank you, Werner said. Good night.
The captain, sitting next to him, pointed at the nearly dark and disappearing ocean and said something. There was still a faint light where they were, 11 kilometers up. Werner was thinking that it was night already in Dakar. In Frankfurt, it was already night.
This is where it went down,
the captain was saying.
What?
Werner asked, his thoughts elsewhere.
Air France 447.
Werner peered into the silvery dimness.
Pretty much on the equator. So what happened?
The captain asked.
Why were you late? There was some sort of accident, Werner said. A traffic accident. Yeah? The taxi I was in hit a scooter, Werner explained. The kid who was on the scooter was killed, I think. Ah, shit, the captain said. Anyway, they had to take the taxi driver away, the police, and I had to get another taxi, which wasn't so easy at that time. Sure, the captain said. That's sad about the kid. Yeah, it is, Werner said. You know, he said a minute later, I had a sister. She died when I was 5. Yeah?
The captain was obviously unsure what he was meant to do with that information. He and Werner knew each other only slightly, and Werner had never told him anything significant about his personal life.
Was she older than you?
The captain asked, trying to show some sort of sympathetic interest.
No, younger. She was 3. That must have been hard on your parents, the captain said.
Werner said that it was. For a while, there were no pictures of Liesel in the flat. Later, there were some again, and it was strange to see them because by then he had forgotten what she looked like. And of course, she still looked the same in those pictures, while he was already a few years older than he had been that day. That was when he first started to think about what she might look like if she had lived. He still thought about that sometimes, not only about what she might look like, but about what her life might have been like. She would be 33 now. When he thought about that, he had an eerie sense of her absence from the world. From the moment they landed in Sao Paulo, he dreaded being alone in a hotel room again. He hated the silent solitude of hotel rooms. This one was on the 23rd floor, with windows that didn't open. He fetched a glass from the bathroom, and the bottle of wild turkey he had picked up as he hurried through the airport and Dakar. He poured some into the glass. And then, even though it was after 2 a.m. in Frankfurt, he tried to phone Zabina again. He tried her, knowing that she wouldn't answer. He had tried her many times in the last 24 hours, and she had never answered, and now it was the middle of the night where she was. And yet his heart still seemed to stop as the numbers were fed with little flicking sounds into networks that stretched to the other side of the world. Seconds passed. Seconds of silence. And then it felt like some kind of miracle, like something impossible actually happening. Her voice was present in his ear, was saying, "Hello, Werner."
"You're still up?"
was all he said in surprise. He was looking out at the silent lights of Sao Paulo, the way they shimmered in the distance, like a mirage.
"Yeah, I'm still up," she said. "How are you?"
"Okay," he told her.
Their talk lasted no more than 5 minutes, and when it was over, he wished he was still in the sky. 4. GRU to YYZ. The next morning, she had to lose the pilot before she could leave. He was still in her bed, asleep.
"Hey,"
she said.
"Hey, I have to go."
He opened his eyes, light blue. There was reddish stubble on his big jaw. He looked around, still not sure where he was. Outside, the last rain of the Sao Paulo summer was falling, audible in occasional plinks and tinks on the window.
"What time is it?"
he finally asked, propping himself up.
"Almost 11, she told him. "I have to leave in 10 minutes.
Looking around in a more focused way now, maybe trying to find his clothes, he wanted to know if he had time for a quick shower.
"Sure," she said, "if you want. But as I say, I have to leave in 10 minutes.
Last night he had wanted to talk a lot first. There was a point when she wondered if talking was all he wanted to do. That happened sometimes. She had swigged from her Heineken and asked him what sort of planes he flew.
"The McDonnell Douglas MD-11F, he told her. "The freighter."
"The freighter?"
she asked, taking another impatient swig. They were sitting next to each other on her sofa.
"Yeah."
"What's that like?"
He shrugged.
"Not so different from flying passengers," he said.
"Do you do that sometimes?"
"Not anymore."
She had one of those moments when the presence of a large stranger in her apartment suddenly seemed surreal, and for a few seconds, even slightly threatening.
"So why'd you switch?" she asked.
He shrugged again. He was perched on the edge of the sofa, as if he wasn't planning to stay long.
"I don't know," he said.
And then,
"The pay's a bit better."
"Better for flying freight around than people?"
"Yeah,"
he said, sort of seeing her point. He tried to explain.
"The freight side is more profitable."
"Okay.
So what do you do?"
he asked. She told him she was a journalist. He didn't seem sure what to make of that. He said,
"So, what sort of, you write things, or?"
"Well, for instance," she said, "I have to fly to Toronto tomorrow to do an interview."
"Ah,"
the pilot said. He seemed to be wondering how this affected their present situation. Then he said,
"Who are you going to interview?"
She told him, "Marion McKenzie." She wasn't that surprised when he said he hadn't heard of her.
"She's a pretty famous writer."
"I don't read much," he admitted.
"She's kind of a heroine of mine."
"You must be excited about that then."
"I am."
She was also nervous, and she had wanted something to take her mind off it. That something had turned out to be him. He was what the app had offered her. When she kissed him, mostly just to end a silence that was starting to turn awkward, he had frozen for a few seconds of startled passivity, and then started kissing her back. While he was in the shower, she looked at her list of interview questions. He had asked her, politely, whether she had a spare towel. She had fetched one and handed it to him. He had thanked her. She looked over the list of questions as she waited for the coffee to froth up in the pan. The first question was about whether Mackenzie felt wiser now than when she was younger, and the sound of the shower was still going on. She hoped she wouldn't have to knock on the door and tell him to hurry up. She should have made him leave last night, obviously. That she had not done that had something to do with an exchange that happened afterwards, as they lay there sweatily in the dark, each seemingly intent on their own thoughts. He had asked her, unexpectedly, how old she was.
33, she said, like it says on my profile.
He was silent for so long that she thought he might have fallen asleep. Then he spoke again. Are you happy? He asked. It was a serious question, and she tried to answer with the same seriousness.
What is happy?
Well, if you had to say whether you were happy or unhappy, he said, which would it be?
She thought about it.
I don't know, she said.
There was another long silence. And then he said, are you happy that you're alive? That was an easier question to answer.
Yes, she said. I'm happy that I'm alive.
She had let him put his arms around her, and he fell asleep like that, holding her as if she was someone he knew. And though she had slipped out of his embrace, she had not woken him. He was sleeping so quietly. She turned off the gas under the coffee and waited while it simmered down. The sound of the shower was still going on, and she went and knocked on the door.
I have to leave in 5 minutes.
The shower stopped.
I have to leave in 5 minutes, she said again.
Okay, his voice said.
There was, she felt, no sense of urgency in it.
Okay,
she asked. Nothing. She went back to the living room, which had the kitchen at one end of it, and poured coffee from the little pan into a mug. She added milk and sugar. She was just lifting the mug to her mouth when she noticed his purple shirt on the floor. That had come off while they were still on the sofa. She put the mug down and took the shirt into the bedroom, where he was unhurriedly toweling his hair.
Here's your shirt, she said.
Thank you, he said.
There was always something exciting about seeing someone naked for the first time, and his nakedness now, the next morning, still had some of that quality. She felt it as she stood there, her heart perceptibly quickening. When he took the shirt from her, he held on to her hand for a moment.
I have to go, she said.
A few minutes later, he appeared in the living room, dressed and looking slightly dazed, as if he still hadn't worked out where he was and what was happening. She said,
my Uber will be here in a minute.
Okay.
He sat on the sofa and started to put on his shoes.
Where are you going?
He asked.
The airport.
Yes.
Guarulhos?
Yes.
Can I come with you?
The question seemed weird.
Why?
She asked, making sure she had her passport.
I need to go there, he said.
Yeah?
As he finished tying his shoes, he said something about supervising the loading of the plane. The freighter, he must have meant, and offered to pay half the Uber fare. She said that wasn't necessary. They took the lift down to street level in silence. Her apartment was in a pale tower, one of several nearly identical ones next to a highway. The tops of the towers disappeared into cloud, and a tangible dampness filled the air outside, where the Uber was waiting, a charcoal Prius slick with moisture. They got in on opposite sides, and she told the driver to take them to the airport. They probably seemed like a couple who had just had an argument, she thought, the way they stared out of their windows at the rainy, gray cityscape as it went past. On either side of the highway, there was dull warehousing, industrial parks. The traffic was heavy, and she looked at her watch more nervously each time the Uber slowed into another tailback or arrived just too late at some lights. At some imperceptible point, As the traffic thickened and their progress slowed, the idea that she might miss the plane started to acquire the qualities of an actual possibility. She leaned pointlessly forward in her seat to look out through the windscreen at the mass of taillights ahead. The pilot said,
"What time is your flight?"
When she told him, he looked at his own watch and said,
"It's tight."
"Yeah," she said.
They had stopped again.
The driver sighed as if in apology, though it wasn't his fault, and tapped his fingers on the steering wheel.
"How long is the flight from here?"
the pilot asked.
"To Toronto?" "9 hours."
"More like 10, she said.
He nodded.
"Yeah. People are always amazed," he said, "how that part of North America is nearer to, like, Moscow than it is to here."
She leaned forward into the space between the two front seats and asked the driver, in Portuguese, whether there was any other way he could go.
He shrugged and said he could try Via dos Trabalhadores.
"Why don't you do that?" she said.
"People have no sense of geography," the pilot said. "How the world fits together, you know."
"Yeah,"
she said.
"Is it Air Canada?"
he asked.
"Yes."
"What aircraft do they use on that sector?"
"I don't know," she said.
The traffic had moved on a little, and they were now first in line at the next lights. She said to the driver,
"Why don't you turn here and take Via dos Trabalhadores?"
Without saying anything, the driver put his indicator on, and when the lights changed, he made the turn, even though he was in the wrong lane. She looked at her watch. Unless they were there in the next 15 minutes, she thought, she would miss it. She might miss it anyway. She should just accept that she had missed it, she told herself. A few minutes later, signs for the airport started to appear. And then a plane, low in the sky, materializing suddenly out of the white vapor. They were nearly there, and she started to think, with something more than mad hope, that she might make the flight after all.
"Will we see each other again?"
the pilot asked. The question surprised her.
"I thought it was fun last night," he said.
"It was. Sure."
They had to stop for the driver to take a ticket from a machine. The pilot said,
"You know, I never slept with a black girl before."
She laughed and didn't know what to say.
"No?"
"No,"
he said, smiling at her.
"Was my first time."
"Okay,"
she said.
"It's Terminal 3,
she told the driver, after looking it up on her phone. He nodded. The pilot was saying something about when he would be in Sao Paulo again. And then they were there, joining a line of parked taxis in front of the mirrored surface of the terminal.
"Thanks,"
she said to the driver, jumping out. The driver more slowly moved round to lift her suitcase from the trunk. She took it from him and thanked him again. The pilot was standing there, in his purple shirt and his sunglasses, despite the lack of sun.
"Bye,"
she said. Then she was dragging her suitcase at a half jog towards the terminal entrance, and didn't hear what, if anything, he offered in return.
5. YYZ to SEA.
She was very apologetic, but she told the interviewer, a young woman who had flown all the way from Brazil, that she had to leave immediately.
"My daughter has just gone into labor," she explained, "in Seattle. The only flight they have today leaves in," she looked at her watch, "exactly 2 hours. So I have to dash. I'm so sorry."
"Oh,"
the interviewer said.
"Well,
I'm so sorry,"
Marion said again, when the woman showed no sign of moving from her sofa.
"Well, would it be okay,"
the interviewer asked, finally standing,
"if I emailed you some questions?"
"Of course it would. Yes, of course. I'm just going to throw some things in a suitcase," Marion said, and she left the room.
She had been in the middle of answering a question about cultural appropriation when the phone had interrupted her. Something had told her